I did not sneak into CIA. My employment was not and is not the result of a fluke or slip through the cracks. I earned my way in, and I earned my way up the ranks of this organization.
Did you really think that when we got you, I would be a nice fucking guy?
When you lie to me, I hurt you.
Grab me the bucket.
Huh?
Come on, grab the bucket.
You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
I am educated, qualified, and competent. And sometimes I struggle. I struggle leaving the office when I feel there's so much more to do. I used to struggle with imposter syndrome, but at 36, I refuse to internalize misguided patriarchal ideas.
You don't mind if my female colleague here checks out your junk, do you? No?
Good.
Dude, would you shit your pants? Do you want the water again, or do you want something else?
I don't know!
I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder.
This is a dog collar. Come on.
No!
You're my dog, I gotta walk you.
I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise.
This box here, this box sucks. And I'm gonna put you in it.
Partial information, I'm gonna go in the box. Partial information, this is treated as a lie.
I stand here today a proud first-generation Latina and officer at CIA.
Monday! Tuesday! Right there!
Know your worth, command your space. Mija, you're worth it.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such as.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie! Out!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Did you guys hear now at the CIA black sites, they're actually chaining people up and forcing them to listen to Remember Shuffle for 50 hours straight? Just Ben's staccato laugh, keeping them awake.
That's awesome.
He's like, please, please, no more George Bush or Michael Scott. I cannot do it anymore.
Now watch this drive.
They only have 6 impressions. Please, I beg of you.
Hey, everybody. It's your Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Giordano.
Go for Bravo. We have an I-95 heading to Paw Patrol for a Pasmir rotor act.
Excellent. And today we are joined in very quick succession since his Star Wars appearance. We are joined by JD. Say hi, JD.
I'm thrilled to be back.
We wanted to record all in person back in our hometown over the holidays, but someone got COVID again. It was fucking me. It got me. It got me again.
Yes, the CIA hit Ben with the COVID gun when they figured out we were doing a torture episode on the pod.
Yes. Giordano, why don't you explain the bit about the topic? Because you have a prepared bit about how people hate movie episodes, right?
Yes, yes. I've gotten a lot of complaints recently from close friends, family, being like, well, so I guess you guys have just become a movie review podcast. That's what the world needs more of, movie review podcasts. And I would like to point out that the movie is a vehicle for topics about the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And often we're talking very little about the actual movie, and we're speaking about is the subtext or context of the movie. And so today we're going to be talking about Zero Dark Thirty.
Wait a minute, Giordano. Didn't this movie come out in 2012?
It did come out in 2012. Yes, that's right, Ben. You've done your research, I see. You know your judo well. However, this movie opens with what many people consider to be the first night of the 2000s, which is September 11th, 2001. And it ends with what sometimes I consider to be the final night of the 2000s, which is May 1st, 2011.
Yes, 5-1, that infamous date that we all know by heart, 5-1, 5-1-11.
The night that we got the season finale of The Apprentice. Everybody remembers that night, the final night of the 2000s. Also the night where we got Bin Laden. So yes, this movie came out in 2012, but the events depicted in the movie are perfectly bookended by the start and end of the decade, and every everything within those years takes place within the 2000s. And we're not really talking about the movie. That's the main point I'm trying to make here, is that this movie serves as a useful vehicle for discussions on torture, CIA black sites, girl bossing, the bearded operator subculture. This movie is such a rich vein of 2000s era topics. Mm-hmm. And we threw this on thinking we would just make fun of it as a bad movie. And it was pretty surprising, actually. It was a pretty surprising experience, I think, for all of us watching this movie together over the holidays. Would you guys agree?
It was surprising at first, and then I fell asleep.
But yeah, I was also pretty drunk.
Yeah, must have been nice.
I had had a few Christmas cocktails at the time, and they caught up with me.
It was not what I expected at all. I thought it was going to be like a Benghazi movie or like a horse soldiers movie, and it was more thoughtful than that. And the first half hour of the movie, which is probably the best part of the movie, is actually really good and based. Unfortunately, it's sort of ruined by the rest of the movie, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, and I would add, just as a closing thought to the hook, we have talked on this pod a lot about the election of Barack Obama and how we felt at the time that that was going to change everything. And this movie, as well as Catherine Bigelow's previous movie, The Hurt Locker, which I watch and I'll pop off a little bit on, it shows you how a good Hollywood lib needs to square the circle of their boy, the thoughtful Democrat, glass ceiling breaking POC president, is going to change everything except for the global war on terror. How do we square that circle? How do we maintain our lib humanitarian values while also relentlessly and ruthlessly pursuing the global war on terror in much the same way as the previous administration had? Because empire is nonpartisan.
Well, Obama did put an end to the torture program.
Oh, yeah, remember when
he
closed Guantanamo Bay successfully?
Yeah, well, these events don't take place at Guantanamo Bay because, as we'll learn later, there's too much supervision at Guantanamo Bay. There's too many laws there. Famous law-having place, Guantanamo Bay.
Yep.
I was talking to Troop Hater about this movie, and he very much agrees with you, Ben. I think he described it as what a liberal anti-war movie looks like. Mm. His take on the movie also included such thoughts as, more like Zero Dark Thirty, am I right?
Hell yeah.
And Catherine Bigelow, what is that, Deuce Bigelow's sister? But yeah, this movie has some very weird politics. They're like lib-brained for sure, because Catherine Bigelow has this reputation for having a very passive tone in her movies. Like, you're just meant to sort of take in this stuff without the movie guiding you towards any concrete opinion. But I do think that the movie subtly pushes you towards a conclusion that torture is good.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey, listen, just be glad you don't have to do it, but be glad that there's someone on your side who's mm-hmm. willing to do this.
Who also... I bet you weren't imagining this when you pictured her was a woman.
Her? Yeah. The torturer said, I can't torture this man. He's my son.
Wait, what? I don't get it.
It's that, yeah, it's normally a doctor joke. Like, I can't operate on this.
Yeah, of course you don't get it, Ben.
Yeah. It's called feminism, Ben.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's like this giant girl boss element of this movie, which is that, hey, what if the torturer was a woman?
Mm-hmm.
Does that change your opinion on it?
Yeah, what if American heroes aren't giant burly men, but are actually like really hardworking thinking women? You ever think about that?
Mm-hmm.
Also worth mentioning, just on a total aside, Catherine Bigelow, one of James Cameron's five wives. So very different approaches to empire, the two of those directors.
Jesus.
Hey, speaking of great lady heroes of American history, it would be remiss not to mention we're recording this on another date that will live in infamy. It is 1/6 right now.
Right.
So I think it 1/6 deserves a shout out. And yeah, it's another lady American hero I think really rose to prominence on that day.
Who?
Ashley Babbitt.
Yeah, oh, yes, yes. Okay.
Nice.
Her name was Ashley Babbitt.
Oh, say her name.
It's neat because she went out like Robert Paulson too.
I do want to say one more bit about this girl bossing thing, which is that it's very much in this lib mentality of, hey, we need more female billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we shouldn't have billionaires at all. It's that we need better representation amongst the billionaires. This identity politics that completely runs contrast to class politics.
Yeah, it is quite literally the meme of the Middle Eastern people getting bombed by drones, and they say, I hear that a woman's going to be sending the next one. Really makes it feel like you're part of something. It is that mean times two, because we have our lady protagonist torturer girl boss, and then the discourse around this Oscar-winning movie and Catherine Bigelow's last Oscar-winning movie was that she was the first female director to win the Oscar. So we had the identity politics around the creator as well as the fictional character.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just to signpost a little bit for this episode, first we're going to talk about the plot of the movie, as not everybody has probably seen it or remembers it.
And we don't want you to watch it, let's be clear.
No. Then we'll talk about torture. Does it slap or is it washed? And CIA black sites and waterboarding. Then we'll move on to our section on girl bossing. And finally on the archetype of the bearded operator.
Yes.
So getting into the plot, I do want to mention a little bit about the era that this movie came out in. 2012, we're starting to see a lot of these operator movies, Act of Valor, SEAL Team 6, this movie, all of them came out in 2012. A couple years later, we'll get American Sniper, 13 Hours. We're very much moving into the special forces era of Army movies, because it seems to be the only, it's kind of the only movies about Iraq that you can make where there's some kind of success. Really tough to make an occupation movie.
Yes.
You know?
You want your movie to have a dub somewhere in it. And I would add, we're getting to the end of Obama's first term, right? Coming into an election year. And he kills bin Laden in 2011. And while I don't think that that guaranteed his victory or whatever, it is something that they definitely leaned on. I can guarantee you, without knowing anything, there are some conspiracy theories out there that the Pakistanis gave up bin Laden to Obama to guarantee his reelection because they're all secret Muslim. Well, the Pakistanis are not secretly Muslim. They're openly Muslim, but that's a good one. I should write on message boards.
So the movie opens with the 9/11 attacks, the September 11th attacks, and there's phone calls from dispatchers with smoke. Actually, it's just set to black. You might think that your video is out.
As we did.
As we did.
As we did. And this is done on purpose. George Tenet said in his book that all major foreign policy decisions after 9/11 were made through the prism of the smoke from the World Trade Center. It colored all of our decision making for the decade that followed. And this movie very much wants you to keep that in mind throughout the film, because first of all, the movie opens with 30 minutes of torture.
Yep.
And anytime you start to feel some level of empathy for these people, the movie will remind you of a terrorist attack that occurred. Be it September 11th, the London bombings that they make up for the movie.
Yep.
It does have to remind you that, hey, these are the bad guys. So actually, all this torture, you know, is justified.
Is necessary. Yeah, there's a hilarious line in the very first scene. They got a guy who's strung up by his arms to cables that are attached to the wall. And they do fucking everything. It's two scenes with the same guy. There's one scene where they beat him up. They waterboard him. They expose him. They starve him. They sleep deprive him. They have him shit himself. They yank his pants down in front of a woman to try and sexually humiliate them. They put a dog collar on him and walk him around. I'm up to 8 things by my counting. And then they threaten to put him in a plywood coffin, essentially. And at one point, the guy torturing him says, "This is what defeat looks like." And I just thought to myself, well, that means that torturing this guy almost to death is what victory looks like. Is this what victory looks like?
Well, technically, yes. He didn't say for whom.
Yeah, and we'll get into like a fully fleshed out section on torture later. But as far as the movie is concerned, the three of us were actually watching this going, oh, nice. This movie is based. It's forcing Americans to actually confront and look at what this horrific torture looks like. Because you hear waterboarding and like, you're like, oh, okay, it seems bad, I guess. And then you watch a gentleman get waterboarded, and such a different experience to actually witness it happening to someone.
Yeah. And in those scenes, they also acknowledge that, yeah, there's just this extrajudicial prison complex where at first Jessica Torturer is wearing her ski mask, and then she goes back in, she doesn't put it on, and she says, "He's never getting out," right? And the dude Torturer's like, "Oh yeah, no, he's not." So there's literally no reason for them to conceal themselves. Yeah, it does kind of make you, the viewer, look at the fucking torture black site archipelago dead in the face.
Mm-hmm. And eventually they trick him into giving out information, which may be apocryphal. I'm not sure if that actually happened. But
when we keep saying there's fictional bombings and it might be apocryphal, this might be a good time to mention that Jessica Chastain's character, Maya, Jessica Torturer, according to the Wikipedia, she is a fictional character. And Giordano was saying he read somewhere that she might be an amalgam of multiple women who worked at the CIA. The point is, this character is not real in the way that Leon Panetta is real in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The movie claims to be based on true events, but we do have this fictionalized protagonist that we're following along.
JD, anything else you want to say about the torture scenes before we move on to the bureaucracy?
Yeah, this is kind of disconnected. A lot of movies of the time and to date are worse for this, but there is, how do I put this non-wokely? There is a lot of like othering of Arab and Afghan and Pakistani people in this mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to put that. And after they've, basically when they're done torturing this guy, they show that they give him like a nice meal.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he spills, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the male torturer character is like, oh yeah, we got, you know, it's food. It's just tabbouleh and hummus. And they go really out of their way to point out like, oh, look, we gave him the food that they like, you know, they love this shit. It's one of those things that this movie does a lot where I can't explicitly point to something and say, oh, they're portraying something as good or bad or what, but it's just like, why is that line in there?
Mm-hmm.
You can see the food on screen, but they still have the male torturer be like, yep, we got you grape leaves and tabbouleh.
Mm-hmm. We got the things that your digestive system can handle,
right?
Because it's biologically ingrained, yes.
Would the line have made sense if, what year is it, 2012?
Mm-hmm.
Would the line have made sense if he was like, yeah, we got you a burger and we put an egg on it? It was like American food. We got you a poutine with pulled pork. Wait, no, shit.
Yeah, no pork.
We got you a a salad bowl.
Yeah. And also, this doesn't have to do with the ideology of the movie, but that guy, okay? He is one of the great that guys, I think, of the coming decade. This
the
might
torturer?
Be like one of his, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know his name, but that guy has always bothered me in a way because there's nothing wrong with his acting. He's a perfectly good actor and he's been a million things and I don't remember his name because he's always cast as the most forgettable person ever. He was the other guy in the Terminator reboot.
Mm-hmm.
He was the other guy in the Planet of the Apes reboot.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this may be his best role I've ever seen him in. He actually is good.
His name is Jason Clark, and
yeah.
I'm impressed. You named a lot of his movies.
Exactly. Hmm. You know, Jason Clark is actually good in this because they do, at least to their credit, genuinely raise these ethical questions of torture and stuff, and they kind of show you this character where he's this cruel, awful torturer, right? But then he's like kind of smooth talking and regular in conversation. And I think that's on purpose. We're supposed to sort of, it makes you think this guy is like, I own you, Amar. I'm going to stick you in a box and make you shit yourself.
Yeah. You see this box? This box sucks.
Yeah. But then, yeah, we can also come out and be like, oh, I have pet monkeys and I eat ice cream.
Yeah. You know. He becomes a lobbyist. He's like, I couldn't deal with it anymore. I had burnout. I had burnout
yeah,
from
right?
torturing
but
people.
But that's actually, thank you, Doriano. That kind of stuff was novel in this movie, but this movie is the woke CIA ad. We'll get to that.
Yes.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But yeah, I felt sorry for Jason Clark yet again, because anyway, this character is almost interesting and yeah, he disappears half an hour into
He does.
Yeah, he got burnt out, man. He needed to focus on his mental health and do a little self-care and walk away from the life.
Yep. He was feeling imposter syndrome. So this movie has three thirds and the first third is concerned with the visceral experience of watching torture. I think it's probably the best third.
Mm-hmm.
The second third is by far the worst.
Yes.
It is just the bureaucracy of the CIA and getting nowhere trying to find information on bin Laden. It's about the frustration that the CIA felt in the mid to late aughts, basically, especially once their torture mandate was rolled back a tiny bit, a fraction after Abu Ghraib. And then the final third is the actual bin Laden raid, where we go back to a visceral experience. And I thought that was actually pretty good as well.
Yeah.
But just getting to this second third, which is almost unwatchable, in that it's not exciting to watch, nor does it actually do that much table setting. Mm-hmm. I watched this movie again this morning, so that's like 5 hours I've put into this movie at this point, and I am no closer to understanding what the movie presents as where the information that they got bin Laden from. They set up a couple safe houses, and then suddenly she just has a model of the house, and she's showing it to CIA director Leon Panetta, played by James Gandolfini, which was, it's awesome to see the big guy on screen, but yes. It's almost impossible to take in Leon Panetta as not as Tony Soprano, you know?
Yeah.
This fucking bin Laden's become a major fucking source of aggravation.
There are fucking known knowns and known unknowns, but there are also fucking unknown unknowns. What the fuck?
That was a surprise to me, too. I didn't know he would be in this movie, so it was a really a surprise to be sure, but a welcome one.
Yeah, and I think there are a few things undercutting this middle third. One is that this movie is incredibly long, but it does have to cover 10 years worth of content. So it moves through a lot of time. Individual scenes are incredibly short, but the pacing is incredibly slow because it's boring. It's a bunch of fucking meetings. It is a bunch of fucking meetings where everyone's talking in a combination of jargon, and then the second thing that undercuts this middle third of the movie is exactly what JD said, is the othering of Middle Eastern people. And I also apologize for using the woke buzzword, but it's a bunch of meetings of CIA people using interchangeable brown names to move the plot along, because they make absolutely no effort to humanize any of these people or to give them any kind of character depth or to give them any kind of backstory. It's like, here's a bunch of bureaucrats talking about some Arabic and Pashto names, and you're like, I am both bored and confused in this third of the movie.
You're right. They just don't do a good job of presenting you with who any of these people are. I've read The Looming Tower, and still when they were talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they were just not doing a good job of presenting who the, like, why, like, who these people are, like, what they're like. Just zero characterization.
What are their connections to Bin Laden? How are the CIA trying to find them? What do they hope to do? None of that shit.
I think this is one of the ways that this movie kind of slaps you in the face a little bit, is because it's either expects you to be a complete article head and just be like, oh yeah, they got this guy, oh my god, so and so mentioned
Abu Ahmed.
Yeah, I was really just trying not to pull an Arab name out of my ass rudely right there.
Abu Ahmed is like one that they use.
Thank
in the movie.
You yeah. Abu Ahmed mentioned. Right, or it assumes that you're the kind of person who thinks an article head is what being smart is, and that you will nod along with this movie. For, by the way, third, these guys are being very generous by calling it a third. It's like the middle hour and a half of the movie.
It's
the middle act. Yes.
Yes. It assumes that you're the kind of person that watches Oscar bait because you want to feel smart and is going to be like, oh yeah, I'm smart for watching this movie with a lot of article names in it.
Yeah. 100% JD.
I didn't want to have JD on the episode just because I've come to learn that JD is much better at impressions than I am. And so I don't really want him on the show as much, but I can't do a Kendall Roy impression if you're somehow able, because Jeremy Strong makes an appearance in this movie, if you're somehow able to do one. But in the meantime, I guess I could take a crack at the Jeremy Strong impression. It's like, Osama's in the house, but it could be a drug dealer, right? And then who gives a fuck? So yeah, just figure it out. I don't know.
You've got the house, Maya? Yeah, you've got the house? Yeah. Okay, we're doing the house? We're doing the house? Okay. I don't know.
I'm the oldest boy. Osama's the oldest boy.
Famously not the oldest boy. No, he's the 15th eldest
boy.
I'm the
11th oldest boy. Jinx.
All right, yeah, it's Succession, but for the Bin Laden construction empire. And so there's 35 characters.
That's a way better bit than CIA Kendall Roy.
That whole bit when Shiv surprises Tom with an open marriage on their wedding night is just not a big deal because of Islamic law.
By the way, this movie also does do the thing where it cuts to another country and does actually do the foreign music drop.
Absolutely. I will say there are some beautiful shots of Pakistan in this movie. Mm-hmm. It really makes you want to go to Peshawar for sure. The beautiful colors, the mountains. Yeah, it's definitely like the best footage I've seen of that region in a movie.
This movie is like shot good.
There's a lot of slice of life shots of just people at fruit markets and stuff that aren't terribly, you know, tell
their background, but you know.
But they do the ululation a lot to remind you where you are for sure.
Yeah, ululation. Thank you. Yeah.
This movie does put, I think, as Ben has said in the past, a spoiler on a Ferrari, in that they put Mark Strong in a rug in this movie. Anyone who is auditioning with the last name Strong, they just put in. But yeah, Mark Strong fully wigged up in this movie.
Yeah, an abomination. Yeah, so in this middle act, this middle 90 minutes, the weird ticking clock that our
hero protagonist is faced with is the gradual rollback of their freedom to torture. That is the dramatic tension, because she's got to find Bin Laden. She needs all the tools in her toolkit. But first, the Abu Ghraib story breaks, with nary a mention of one Seymour Hersh, I would point out, who broke that story, if I recall correctly. And then Obama gets elected. gets elected, and he's taken away our heroes' tools. And there's an actual line where that guy that JD was praising, whose name I already forget because he's a that guy, says the actual line from the movie, "You watch it. You don't want to be the last one holding the dog collar when the oversight comes." Not, "You don't want to work a job where you walk human beings along like they're dogs." Just, you don't want to get caught with the dog collar, you know?
Yeah. Hey, she only had 6 years to waterboard people. She needed more time, but the damn administration wouldn't let her do her job.
Yeah. And we have this, again, fictionalized character is at the center of three different terrorist attacks. There are two very directly and then one adjacently, where we see the bombing of the buses in London in like 05. We have a bit where she's talking to her boss, but the threat Al-Qaeda presents, and he brushes her off, and wouldn't you know it, boom, London attack. Then, and this is all in very quick succession, there's a scene where she's meeting up with her girly bestie at work at the Marriott in Islamabad, and they're just trying to drink some wine, have a good time, literally talk about boys. They literally talk about whether or not Maya has fucked that guy yet, and boom, another terrorist attack right next to them. They need to duck out through the kitchen, because this is a favorite spot of Westerners. Then there's a third lead. In this one, they get by bribery instead of by torture. They talk about how they're going to open the checkbook, give this guy $25 million. But you know what? You, audience member, bribery just doesn't work. Not the same way torture does. Because the lead comes to this Air Force base in Afghanistan, drives his car in, boom, suicide bomb, and her work bestie is killed. And like, there was an actual suicide bombing at this Air Force base, but it's nothing like the movie presents.
It was at the gate, right?
Yeah, he was at the gate. He was a known commodity already, not some new lead or whatever the fuck. It's totally embellished so that they can drive 2 points home, which is point number one, bribery doesn't cut it the way torture does. Point number two, you gotta listen to the women. You gotta listen to what they say in your torture machine.
And for the fifth time in this movie, it just got personal for the Jessica Chastity character.
Yeah, they have to do so much work, like you said, to make it personal. Now that you mention it, does this movie pass the Bechdel test? Yes, those girls, those women talk in the kitchen at one point. However, yeah, even that restaurant scene, they still manage to have to talk about a dude, as Ben pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
The other lady CIA girl boss is introduced, and they use that scene to explore sort of a, like, women sometimes also have to deal with other women in the workplace, too, because she's new, and the elder lady at her office is, like, doubting her and doesn't like being talked over by the younger woman, but they become pals. But yeah, the movie is showing that it knows how boring it is, because they're doing another one of their meeting scenes, like the 12th CIA agents meeting and talking scene, and they're like, we can't just do another one of these. So they get bombed in the middle of one of their meeting scenes. That's sort of right in the middle of the movie. It's like they know that if we do one more meeting scene, they're gonna start noticing that this movie is just meeting scenes. So they get bombed and then are unharmed, and then the movie goes on with zero impact on the plot from that bombing, besides it's now a little more personal.
Yep.
You probably could have taken out the scene where her car just gets attacked coming out of her condo too.
Oh right, I forgot.
Yeah, it is just another scene of look how difficult it is for her, but nothing's really being overcome or advancing. We already know, I guess it's supposed to show that even in her safe house she's not safe. It's a little bit of like, oh, even in Pakistan they're out to get her, or the implication that the Pakistanis are against us.
And it's showing you that Jessica Torture, she just don't quit.
That's also, she just doesn't quit.
Unlike you, viewer, who wants to quit watching the movie. You gotta power through like Maya.
Yeah, I think it's trying to speak to the feckless people out there who wanted to give up the search for Obama. Wanted to give up the search for Bin Laden, sorry. We're after 6 years, because that's the point. At one point, the guy whose name I always forget, the Irish looking guy, comes into the room and is like, we've gotten 4 of the top 20 guys in 6 years. They are frustrated. Nothing is going right for them. And this is the only job she's had. We learned that she was recruited out of high school. She's the LeBron James of being a CIA torturer. And they haven't caught anybody yet. This is the low point.
I hear the CIA are changing the rules, though. You now got to spend 2 years torturing in college before you're eligible to go pro.
Should we move on to the last third?
Yeah.
Well, I would like to point out, to catch us back up to where we actually just were, which was the bombing of the Air Force base, is that scene may be the low point of the movie, because it is the most "this is my boat, the live forever" scene
yes,
ever put to film. It's so bad.
Yeah, you see it coming a million miles away, where Maya's back in America texting her friend on the Air Force base, and her friend on the Air Force base literally says, you better get a bottle of wine and get ready to open it in celebration, because this is it. We got him. And the movie just keeps cutting to like her fucking CIA torturer Slack app being like, message me she's when he's AIM. There.
They're also talking like BFFs to each other. She's like, hey, what's up, girl?
Yeah. It's cutting to Maya's office back to this Air Force base that the friend character is the other lady torturer is in. Sorry, not torturer. She bribes. She's new school now, right? Even though she was old school before. Meanwhile, there, all of the army guys are like, what, you're going to just let this guy in? You're going to just let this car right into the base? And she's like, trust me, I bribed him. I used the non-torture coercion methods. It's fine. They, this whole thing where all the guards, they stand down, including the guy walking, just going directly back into the guard tower to let this car in.
They do make a point that they're like, bribery also doesn't work and actually results in people getting killed.
Yeah, they let the car literally drive just directly up to our characters.
This movie fucking stinks.
Yeah.
This act certainly does, yeah. But then we get to the final act of the movie, which is the Bin Laden raid, starring Chris Pratt, Andy Dwyer.
Yeah, this is the movie he got hot for. This is the movie he got shredded for before he did Guardians of the Galaxy.
So she, like, basically convinces everybody that this house is where Obama... that this house is where Bin Laden is living. And she's 100% sure. She feels it in her gut. Yes. You remember feeling it in your gut, feeling confidence? And if you feel it in your gut that it's true, then it is true. Just like the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Guys like us, we're not some brainiacs on the nerd patrol. We go straight from the gut. Right, sir? That's where the truth lies. Right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now I know some of you are going to say I did look it up, and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut.
Yes, and no one believes her. No one believes the woman. They do not hashtag believe all women, the CIA. Sorry, we're going to cut that. That's a fucking 2014-ass joke.
No, I like that.
Well, 2014-ass movie.
Yeah, it is 2014-ass movie. So they take a couple Black Hawk helicopters into the Bin Laden compound and immediately crash one of them.
Yes.
Which they had to keep in because, yeah, that did happen in real life. And the whole raid is shot in real time, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that Austin Powers joke where the countdown is at 10 seconds, but that scene takes 2 minutes to actually happen? This movie is actually showing you the chronology of the raid in real time, and it makes it much more engaging. And it's mostly silent. It's like mostly seen through the point of view of the night vision goggles. They're slowly getting into the house, killing more and more of the residents, including some of the teenage girls who live there.
Yep.
Who are in the harem. Yeah, I guess it is like kind of funny. A lot of the stuff is bullshit in this scene for sure. We've since learned that these guys like were tripping over each other like the Three Stooges to try and get upstairs first so that they could be the person who kills Bin Laden and therefore could go on Joe Rogan and write the world's shittiest book after, which they do make allusions to in this movie. Mm-hmm. Chris Pratt at the end is like, hey, if you guys have been listening to Tony Robbins, I got a business idea I want to start.
Yes.
While they're doing the raid on the house, they also do their honeypot voice to try and lure out a few of these guys successfully. So they're like, Khalid, Khalid.
That was so weird. We were getting ready to watch this movie. I think it was the only person who had seen it before, but I saw it when it came out from like a hot couch living room. I only have vague memory of it, but I was really excited for you guys to be seeing it for the first time. And yet my main stated goal was, I can't remember if the scene where they have an impressionist Navy SEAL do an impression of a woman to lure one of the men out, if that was real or just a fever dream I had. And yeah, that happens. One of the Navy SEALs, I guess, is just like a savant impressionist and is somehow able to convincingly imitate one of this person's female family members well enough to make him come out. It's so bizarre. Did someone say that happened or what?
Yeah. Would you not hear the Anglo accent on the names like Khalid and Anwar or whatever?
Oh, what? Did they do the Hamas thing to the dialogue?
I think they did. I think one of them did. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'm not really equipped to identify that stuff quite as well as maybe you are. But can we explain just briefly what happens? First of all, these Navy SEALs show up and they're shooting people and whatever. And at one point, I think someone's supposed to be in a room. And so they pull one of these bug night vision goggles operators up, and he literally, like a Looney Tunes bit, is like, yeah, what's the name? Khalid?
Yeah.
Khalid. And the dude, it works. It's portrayed as working.
It works.
This like 6'3" Navy SEAL does a falsetto, and it makes the guy waft towards it like he's fucking floating through the air at like a delicious pie or something.
Yeah, JD, it happens at least twice, maybe three times with three different
later
names.
They, I don't think they do the girl voice, but it's how they get Bin Laden at the end. The one guy, I don't think it's a girl voice that time, but he's like, Osama.
Mm-hmm.
And it also works.
Yeah. It's about as convincing as Willem Dafoe's in drag costume from our Boondock Saints episode that JD came on for.
Yes. No, I mean, it's a really good scene because, like Jordano said, it's in real time. It shows the discrepancy in what the SEALs have and the people that they're fighting, right? Mm-hmm. They got the giant night vision goggles through which we, the audience, see the raid. They got the fucking breaching explosives. They got enough explosives on them to blow up their downed helicopter. They got just a body bag prepared. They got all their guns. They got the world's best impressionists on them. And they're going up against...
have Robin Williams with them. That's actually how he died. The CIA had to cover it up. He was like, oh, hello, I'm here. Oh, Khalid. Come on downstairs.
And yeah, they have all this shit at their disposal. And as Jordano said, they're just gunning down teenage girls left and right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, to the movie's credit, the raid scene is very not sensationalized. Mm-hmm. And they do show, a woman sort of reaches for a gun and they kill the woman too. And
the woman isn't reaching for a gun. She's just screaming because her husband got shot. So they shoot her. So they're like, too loud. Sorry.
No, I think she was diving over him for his AK. But regardless, okay, they are showing that they're just kind of.
Yeah.
They do show that they're just extrajudicially executing a family. They don't sugarcoat that.
Yeah.
And I give the movie credit for that. And it does show how, it is an assassination. These people have no chance. There's three fire teams of Navy SEALs using breaching charges. And they show them, fail to breach a door at one point.
Mm-hmm.
It's way less sensational than like a war movie would be. And I do give the movie credit for that. That this drama, I think by virtue of being a drama, is able to do a really good down-to-earth military action kind of scene.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said earlier about Catherine Bigelow, is she has a reputation for having this very passive tone. And she does that with the torture, and she does that with the military operation, and maybe probably with the meetings a little bit too much too, where she's not taking a side or specifically highlighting a person as a main character or the way that a character should exist in like some kind of fictionalized work. It just lets you observe events without any kind of implication over what's right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's very effective, like in this last scene. I just think that, if you're going to make a movie where you sort of imply that torture is good, you can run into some kind of moral
problem. And ideological problem, yes.
Right, exactly.
I think the final scene of the movie kind of hits this problem on the head, Jordano, where Jessica Torturer gets on her giant military plane and she's a hero. Oh, sorry. First, before that happens, they get back to the base in Afghanistan and Jessica Torturer Chastity is the one who identifies Bin Laden. They unzip the body bag and they let just the nose and beard show, which is a little weird.
That's what was left.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Not a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing that this movie fails to mention as well, is that these guys, you know, the professional operators canoed Bin Laden.
Yeah. And so Jessica nods, and you overhear someone say, I wrote this line down. Classic baby drill bossing move here. So the military guy, after Jessica nods, says, the agency expert gave visual confirmation. Yes, the girl, sir. Like, the person on the phone didn't believe her. That's one of the final lines in the movie. But the final scene is that Jessica gets on this giant military aircraft, and she is the hero. She did it. She got Bin Laden, not those Navy mm-hmm. SEALs guys. And so the pilot says, you must be important. Where do you want to go? I will fly you anywhere in the world on this empty military cargo plane. This is her moment of triumph. And what does she do? She starts crying because she won, but she feels bad about it, which is kind of what this movie is about. We got the empire, we got torture, but we're going to feel bad about it. Lib Hollywood Obama style propaganda movie.
Right.
I will defend the movie for that. I didn't interpret it as that, as it being she feels bad about it. I interpret it as that sort of your task is done catharsis.
Mm.
You know, when you're doing, when you're busy doing something difficult, you're kind of emotionally detached. And then when it's done, the pressure is over and the emotions just pour through. Mm. Honestly, I think that was one of the best parts of the movie.
Mm.
Was that ending? Because that's how I interpreted that, was it's like she has been, had her emotions pushed aside for like 10 years doing this crazy burnout inducing task. And then the task is done and suddenly like,
JD, emotions. I think you're projecting your own feelings about watching the movie onto the character. You had just detached and watched that, it for 2 hours and 40 minutes, and then you were done, and it all came out like a dam.
Well, that's you guys' fault. You had me T-posing with my fingers hooked up to the electric in the wall. T-posing on a box the whole time. What do you expect? It's difficult.
We needed to deepen our understanding for the episode. So we did, in fact, torture JD for the episode. We waterboarded him. We put him in the box. He was actually really good at being in the box.
The box,
I will say,
really
it didn't really feel
me.
Like
I'm
torture.
Flexible. Really flexible. Yeah, the box actually was sick. I was hoping they would take a picture.
I was like, are you ready to get out? And he's like, could you leave me in here a little longer?
You know, I've always liked to be swaddled, put underweight.
Big weighted blanket guy, JD.
Yeah, pressure from all sides kind of stuff.
I have a couple more points from the raid section. So yeah, in real life, they actually will take a picture of the victim's ear or eyes and then send that back for confirmation. You can identify someone that way. It's very funny that the operators, or everybody in the CIA, says Geronimo, which is the code word for success, considering, yeah, Geronimo is like a Native American warrior who fought against the United States mm-hmm. in guerrilla attacks.
Bit of a Zapata oil sort of situation.
Yes.
And I want to mention that on their way out, they also grab as many hard drives as they can, because it's like intel. And one of the pictures they found on those hard drives that they took from the Osama compound was this picture of James Gandolfini holding SpongeBob SquarePants' nose, like a giant SpongeBob SquarePants. So I just like to think about Osama bin Laden looking at this picture frames, you know, and being like, oh, this is my favorite picture of American culture. And also, there is a line where the operator who shot bin Laden, someone asked him, hey, do you realize what you just did? He's a little bit in shock. He's like, I shot the guy on the third floor. Like, he can't believe that he did it. This is completely apocryphal, because we know that these guys, against their orders, ran upstairs to try and be the first one to do it. So
there is actually something important about the raid scene, and I'm sorry to keep us here. That is another one of this movie's just bizarre portrayals of languages and countries. And I genuinely hope one of you guys, or perhaps one of our lovely commenters, can genuinely tell me what the hell is going on here. During the raid scene, as they're attracting more attention with their helicopters and explosions and stuff, the locals start going onto their roofs and rubbernecking and looking at what's happening. And eventually some of them are shambling zombie-like towards the compound, right?
Yes.
And the SEALs have their interpreter on a megaphone yelling in what I assume to be Urdu, you know, stay back or whatever, you know? And they keep coming. Yeah. Again, shambling zombie-like, like some sort of Antifa BLM thugs. just shambling towards our Navy SEAL heroes, right?
Or like the Somalis in Black Hawk Down.
Yes.
Yeah, which is that weird trope, and that movie is something I want us to do one day. And they keep coming, and then what happens near the end of the scene? He yells at them in English, "Go away, they will shoot you." And then it works, and they all turn around.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering about that too this morning, and I was like, is the implication that once they know that these guys are American, they're respected?
Like, no, I think the idea is that they're feared, because Catherine Bigelow does something very similar in The Hurt Locker, where their interpreters will be talking in Arabic instead of Pashto, because it's set in Iraq, and the people won't really be listening to them, and then some U.S. Marine just shouts angrily in English, and people start taking it seriously. And I think the idea is, like, the way I read both of those scenes is, it's one thing if you have the little Imperial lapdog yap, yap, yapping for the occupiers. That's an opinion you can kind of ignore, and you can push the envelope a little bit. But once the guys with the guns and the night vision goggles start yelling at you in English, even if you don't know what it means, you can tell from the tone that maybe it's time to turn around and go back.
Ah, cool. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Wow. It's actually,
that's how I read it. That's all.
No, that's almost certainly the real explanation. It's actually kind of smart.
And you know what the implication is? That we're respected around the globe. Fear, respect, it's all the kind of bundled up in the same package, you know? All right, so yeah, we'll move on to themes. Okay, so we have three themes for this movie. Everybody's favorite section of Remember Shuffle, the themes. And the first one, it has to do with torture in the 2000s, or as Dick Cheney put it, the enhanced interrogation technique. Because I don't know if you guys knew this, but the torture is real. We actually did torture people in real life.
Oh yeah, also, unironic trigger warning for what we're about to describe in detail.
There's a great New Yorker article on this. So during the Cold War, we also did torture, sure, you know, as it's portrayed in movies, very much in like a Clockwork Orange style way, where we were finding scientists to do it, to find the right ways to psychologically distress someone through science and magic. And we'd find these crackpots who would be like, yes, you have to sous vide the guy first. And
yeah, actually, anyone who's read The Shock Doctrine will know that Canada even got involved. There was some really cutting edge research on psychological torture that was done at McGill University. Ooh, my alma mater. Go Redmen. Oh. Yeah, I mean, this guy experimented with giving people just like liters of LSD and keeping them locked up and just seeing what would happen to try and kind of reset their brains. So even Canada got in on the research and development sector of the torturing.
Yeah, so we kind of had this institutional knowledge of torture during the Cold War, which after the Cold War ended, we put it away and we lost this institutional knowledge of torture. We didn't know how to do it anymore. Our torture muscles had atrophied. And so when 9/11 happens, Dick Cheney, the pressure from him was extremely intense. He told the CIA, he was pushing them. He said, we have 96 hours to find people and torture them, get information, do not let us get hit again. And so in this scramble, they searched through the CIA's archives to see, what do we have on the torture and interrogation? And they ended up trying to piece together previous torture techniques that had been used, including what was called the Phoenix Program during the Vietnam War, sort of their notes on torture between 1970 and 1971. A torture program, which I'll mention, by the way, 97% of the Viet Cong targeted by the Phoenix Program were of negligible importance. So this is the program they modeled their program after. And they didn't know how to do it. They restart the program and they're just throwing stuff against the wall to see what sticks. Quite literally, there's a torture called the wall method, where you throw someone up against a wall repeatedly. And you're supposed to do it with plywood, so they kind of bounce off of it, but they use the wrong type of wood and just killed a guy.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Sorry, they didn't kill him. They gave him brain damage so bad that he couldn't testify in court later.
They made him mentally unfit to testify.
So they're trying everything. It's like there's no bad ideas in a torture brainstorm. You know, they're doing waterboarding, claustrophobia, freezing, sexual humiliation, sleep deprivation. They're making them listen to Remember Shuffle for 50 straight hours. I don't know if you guys knew this. So apparently if your body doesn't sleep for like 10 days, it causes organ failure. And so they're trying to see how close they can get to that line without causing these people to die, famously by playing like metal music and stuff like that.
And to give you an idea of the scale, the numbers of guys is in the hundreds. I don't think it cracks the thousands, but it's hundreds of guys, which is a lot. And a lot of these guys are subjected to torture hundreds of times.
Yes. They also kill people. I think there was this idea that waterboarding was safe and it felt like torture, but you aren't actually causing any bodily harm to these people, which is 100% wrong. We killed people because there was also this method where they would hang them by their arms and then leave them out in the cold, and they weren't able to keep themselves warm, and a couple people just freeze to death. It was just straight up torturing people to death. No sensibility about waterboarding seems bad, but
it only feels like you're drowning. You're not actually drowning, right? It's like the aspartame of drowning.
Just the drowning without the guilt. Like, hilarious concept for sure. Like, it only feels like you're drowning. Because it very much does seem like you're doing a cost-benefit analysis for torture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're doing, it's literally libs saying that facts don't care about your feelings. Just because you feel drowned does not mean that we're traumatizing you. That right. is the thing that they're saying.
Yes.
And on that whole vein of politically correct, would you allow U.S. interrogators to waterboard terrorist prisoners?
Absolutely. This question was in the previous debate, and they asked it of Ted Cruz. What do you think of waterboarding, and what would you do, and how bad? And he was like really weak on it. He was, he didn't want to get involved because he thought waterboarding was bad. So, it's bad, but it's not like, it's not chopping off heads, folks, okay, that I can tell you. So, they asked him, and he really gave a very incomplete answer. It was a terrible answer. He was stumbling and mumbling, and he's going like, I don't know. Okay. Then they asked the question to me, what would you do? I said, I'd prove it immediately, but I'd make it also much worse. And don't tell me it doesn't work. Torture works, okay, folks? Torture, you know, I have these guys. Torture doesn't work. Believe me, it works, okay? And waterboarding is your minor form. Some people say it's not actually torture. Let's assume it is. But they asked me the question, what do you think of waterboarding? Absolutely fine. But we should go much stronger than waterboarding. They're chopping off heads. Believe me, we should go much stronger because our country's in trouble. We're in danger. We have people that want to do really bad things. Remember the power of weaponry. This isn't 100 years ago where we fight hand-to-hand combat. This is weapons that are so destructive, that the world could end. Waterboarding is fine, but it's not nearly tough enough, okay?
And it's funny that in so many of these debates, friend of the show, Megan McArdle, had a piece where she pointed out that in the debates around torture, even the anti-torture voices weren't doing it necessarily for any moral reasons, but were mostly doing it on the grounds of effectiveness, which is people say anything to make the torture stop, which we see in the opening scene of Zero Dark Thirty. They say, when is the attack? And the guy just starts saying every name of the week just to make it stop. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, whatever. And Megan McArdle, that absolute fucking psychopath, said, in the future, we might have brain scans so we could rip out your fingernails while you're in an MRI tube and we'd be able to know if you're lying or not. And then the anti-torture voices wouldn't have an intellectual leg to stand on because they built their whole case around effectiveness rather than morality.
Yeah.
Well, they do give them spicy potatoes with garlic sauce after, so it's fine.
The basic argument against torture should be a moral one, of course. That it's wrong. But there's no way to like elucidate that in an argument, I guess. So I think people usually just go for the effectiveness because it is one of those hilariously dark things where like not only is it morally wrong, but it also just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's libs giving up on believing in things just to try to argue with ostensible right-wing liberals on their own turf instead of just being like, I'm going to take a stand and just say this thing is bad, right? We can all look around us and just say this thing is bad.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These libs are incapable of doing that. They got to start from a position of weakness by arguing on like Republicans' terms by being like, listen, we can agree that torture is fine, but don't you guys realize it's like not working?
pin yourself up for success. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't you guys want to set yourself up for success?
Imagine if the 19th century abolitionists had debated in this way. Listen, we know it's okay that you hold these people in bondage. Okay. We get it. It's fine. But wouldn't it be more effective to pay them? Wouldn't you get better labor out of them if you weren't paying for their food and housing?
Yes. They were making the economic argument against slavery that actually, yeah, you're better off hiring someone and not dealing with the associated costs of owning a person.
I'm just telling you, the overheads that you're paying for these quarters and these overseers are cutting into your profit margin. Beauregard, fucking Jimbo the Third.
Yeah, the amount that it doesn't work is incredible, truly. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times in 1 month. I don't know what you hope to get on the 70th waterboarding that month that you couldn't get on the 40th, that you couldn't get on the 150th.
Listen, I just got in from Guantanamo, and boy, are my arms tired from holding up the gallon jug over Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for hours.
You can't do this at Guantanamo. There's too much supervision.
That's right.
You have to do it at a CIA black site.
Which, by the way, is stuff that this movie says.
Yep.
We are on themes, right? Have we driven home hard enough that this movie is not subtle in these what would you call them, like messages, right? Mm-hmm. Like there is literally a scene where they literally are like, well, yeah, can't do it there because they don't let us do the torture there.
Yep, yep.
Mm-hmm. Ever since Obama stopped us from doing torture, now we can't get shit.
Yep. In the first 30 minutes of the movie, we travel to three different CIA black sites. One in Pakistan, one in Afghanistan, one in fucking Poland.
I should mention a little bit about CIA black sites if you don't know what they are. There's something that lawyers cooked up. Basically, the issue with places like countries,
sovereign nations,
and even Guantanamo Bay is that there's a record of who enters and exits, and there are laws that exist typically in a country. But if you can get a country, a simp country like Bulgaria or Poland, to set up a CIA black site in your country, then you're essentially creating a legal zone in which there are no laws or records. And so without any laws, it means that anything you do is technically legal because there's no law against anything. So you can do war crimes. And this is where the CIA was doing its torturing.
Those Poland ones must have been tough because, you know, when I imagine a torture room, it's like a dark room with one light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And I know, like, whenever that went out, it must have been a whole ordeal to get that thing changed. Sorry, I'm trying to bring some levity to the torture episode.
The guy actually froze to death because they had closed the room using a screen door. Oh, man. The old screen door on the black site. It's about as useful as a screen door on a black site. But yeah, I mean, I guess this is where we get some of the great Dick Cheney, king of euphemisms, by the way, the enhanced interrogation techniques. Also, their techniques were called learned helplessness. Oof. And this is where you make someone psychologically dependent on you. I should also note that none of this fucking worked, right? One, it's almost impossible to establish the efficacy of these programs because it's not like they keep data. There's no transparency at all. And if they had actually gotten a big win, I'm sure they would have publicized it, right? Because we know about the torture. We don't know about any of the wins. Now, how did the United States actually get information leading to Bin Laden? Well, that guy who was waterboarded 183 times, you know how he was captured? Through a bribe. Because that's what I do. What the United States does well is bribe people. Because, hey, if you have an $800 billion military budget, say what you want about America, but $800 billion can still buy you a hell of a lot of Ferraris.
Gold-plated Ferraris. Give me the chic.
Oh, yeah.
Give me the chic.
I forgot about the Lambo.
So this is what the United States should be leveraging, is what it does best, which is making consumer goods and money. And that's how they got Bin Laden, was through an ISI bribe. And of course, the movie we're making fun of, because the movie never points you towards this conclusion at all. It's extremely passive. It actually goes the opposite way and says bribes don't work. They actually get people hurt because you're extending the olive branch or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we roast John McCain a lot on this program for being a terrible pilot and losing his election. But praise him
him for his anti-imperialism, discharging that weapon on that aircraft carrier. John McCain criticized this movie because John McCain was tortured a lot in Vietnam. And he criticized this movie for essentially rewriting, in what is meant to be a true story, completely rewriting how they found bin Laden. One of his big spiels was like, none of the torture led to the assassination of bin Laden. It was bribes and boring intelligence gathering. And then they did that thing with the vaccines. Please don't cancel me, Google AI, scanning for any mention of fucking vaccines. But they sent like the guy to give shots in Pakistan. They found his DNA or whatever. I forget all the details, but none of the waterboarding. And this movie's like, no. It did something.
It was all, yeah, it was all a combination.
It's a team effort, you know?
But that is funny when John McCain has to be like, I was tortured and it wasn't useful. What a fucking morbid idea that
John McCain is the voice of reason.
He was tortured.
Yeah. No, it's a good thing we have to vote blue no matter who, because they're the only people that, you know.
I want to mention one quick controversy around America and their relationship to torture. The game GTA 5 came out in the year of our Lord 2013, if I'm not mistaken, 1 year after Zero Dark Thirty. And I remember there being a faux controversy in which you had a classic Rockstar GTA built-in minigame mission in which you had to torture an innocent Middle Eastern man. You had to electrocute him with the fucking car battery. You could waterboard him. You hovered your player avatar over different torture devices, and you had to do it to advance the story. And if you type in GTA 5 torture controversy, you'll see a lot of article heads writing about this, writing about how the satire misses the mark and that they shouldn't have the player be forced to do this or whatever. And it's like, how is this the controversy and not the 180 times they waterboarded KSM? Again, part of the 2010s pivot where we're going to really obsess over culturally criticizing art now.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of art and criticism, there's that funny story about Christopher Hitchens, who hilariously was his intention to prove that waterboarding wasn't that bad? And so he did it to himself.
I don't know what the goal was in doing it, but he did get his ass waterboarded, yes.
Yeah, in an effort to make it about him. He had to do it to himself to say that it was bad. And he said, if waterboarding does not constitute torture, then there's no such thing as torture.
Yes.
It's literally something I think that was like cooked up by the Americans in the Philippine-American War as a fucking 19th century torture against guerrillas that we're reviving. We're rebooting everything these days.
Yeah, and I will never not mention this on the pod. I can't remember if I have already. I think I have. Sean Hannity, who is still on the air, unlike Hitchens. Where are your ratings now, Hitch? Sean Hannity, after that Hitchens little media cycle where we were debating whether or not it was torture, and then we had Hitchens do his little field work and say that it was, Sean Hannity, because he's a big national security, support the troops in all respects guy, Sean Hannity said he would get waterboarded and never did. So we as a society are owed one Sean Hannity waterboarding.
Sean Hannity, come on the pod. I have the plastic water jug ready to go. So just to finish up this torture section of torture in the 2000s, I just want to mention the end of the program. So Obama, he commissioned a Senate report on CIA torture. However, the report was largely seen as an effort in fact-finding and future prevention, and explicitly not a governmental path towards any possible project of accountability or punishment for past interrogation or torture. So no effort to actually correction, one man was prosecuted for the CIA's torture program, and it was the whistleblower John Kiriko. One guy went to jail, and he's still looking for a pardon because he can't get his fucking pension, even though he's out of jail Christ. Now. I actually want to have him on the pod at some point. He's a really terrific and entertaining speaker, has some great prison stories.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, closing up this talk about torture and CIA black sites, it's fucked because there's this idea that Foucault talked about called Foucault's boomerang, which is namely that the TLDR, because reading Foucault is not an enjoyable experience most of the time. The TLDR is that when the French security forces were doing counterinsurgency stuff in the 50s and 60s in Algeria, Foucault posited that all of the techniques that they would learn would boomerang back. You know, as the Simpsons said, you're throwing sticks, dunk dunk, boomeranged on us. And Sure enough, in 1968, when you had the student uprisings, the French security forces did exactly that. And before, when there was like a fucking coup in the 50s in France, I don't know all the details, but when you wonder why cops dress in riot gear and look like occupying forces, that's an example of Foucault's boomerang. This Foucault's boomerang is happening now, where the Chicago police operated a black site in the 2010s and straight up killed people at the Chicago police's black site. So,
wow.
Yeah, 2000s decade, still with us. Okay, on that happy note, should we move on?
That's really interesting. We can always count on Ben for the philosophy topic, whether it be Foucault's boomerang or Theseus's ship.
You know?
So yeah, the next section of our show is the baby drill bossing section of the show.
I'm so glad we're getting to it, because I think we've really understated how much this movie is about this. This is what the movie is about, is this.
I was shocked. I listened to some other podcasts about this movie and nobody else brought this up. And I've been sticking my chest out ever since, because I'm like, only the shufflers are capable of seeing the girl boss angle to this movie. And I don't know how you miss it. It is the main part of the whole thing. It is like, well, what if the torturer was a woman? Yeah, I bet you thought the torturer was a man. There's just so many scenes showing her breaking the glass ceiling of torturing. Mm-hmm. And have you guys read Amber Frost's book?
Not yet.
No.
Oh, okay. She has a great chapter in there about identity politics and specifically gender identity politics. One of her essays is about how they can serve to undermine class interest. And a lot of times that's what lib art feels like, is this attempt to say, yeah, you know what? You could become a female billionaire. Mm-hmm. So the billionaires aren't a problem as long as they're 50% women.
Yes.
As long as 90% of the wealth is owned by 1% of people who are half women, then I don't see a problem here. And that's what this movie is trying to do by saying, hey, as long as we're giving equal opportunities to both men and women torturers, then everything's shipshape.
Yep. Yeah. And what if the contributions of the women torturers were completely unappreciated in their male-dominated environment, right? Again and again and again in these movies, we see her bosses, who are all white males, don't take her seriously because she's a woman. At the field of fucking torturing, the movie is not self-aware enough to be like, it would not be good for women to thrive at this horrible job administering and managing empire. That's not the dub you think it is, god damn it.
Yeah, I can't stress enough that this is the main thing that the movie is about. People are always doubting her. The movie starts with her being new, and even the older woman at the office is like, ugh, another, and then it goes all the way to the people, you know, they want to move on. They don't want to get Bin Laden, right? There's other people that they could get, but nevertheless, she persists.
Yes. Nevertheless, she persisted. Yes.
Down to the end where they do what is, if you devil's advocate, take the whole perspective of this movie as good, as proper, as correct. That line at the end is brilliant, where the guy says, the acid has confirmed it, sir. Yes, the girl. Because it is showing that even after she's won, she's done everything right, they still just call her not even the woman, the girl. And yeah, if you do swallow wholesale the ideology of this movie, that is a brilliant line. But that does sum up what the movie is actually about.
You can't help but notice that she is maybe the most fictionalized character in this story. In order to tell the girl boss story, they need to invent a girl boss at the CIA.
And how close is that to the house?
About a mile.
4,221 feet. It's closer to 0.8 miles.
Who are you?
I'm the motherfucker that found this place, sir.
Really? All right, I want to know more about who's inside this house by the end of the week.
Slay. Oh, like, yes.
The motherfucker.
Slay, queen.
There is always an attempt to show her, to reinforce that she is a girl in a man's world, because they'll bring her back to like a female environment where she gets to be more girly. She's having a conversation with one of her friends over dinner, and her friend's like, so, are any of the torturers you work with cute guys? And she's like, I don't know, kind of, but I don't want to be like that girl in the torturer office.
Yeah, I don't want to be the guy who sleeps around at the torture factory. And you know what her friend says? She's like, you need to date them. Just get yours, girl. Just like, get a little D, have a little fun.
At no time is her character like, I'm not going to fuck a guy who's psychotic enough to do like sexual humiliation to other people.
Hey, he's kind of cute, but I also saw him electrocute a man's balls clean off. And it kind of...
Yeah, I thought he was cute. And then for 2 months, I watched him feed a man hummus through his ass through suppositories, which is a thing that actually happened.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Did they point out that it was hummus before they did it?
not in the movie. This happened in real life.
No, that's what I mean. For the audience's benefit in real life, did they point out, this is hummus. You like this. This is your food.
Well, JD, you know, it would just be something more along the lines of, this is hummus.
Oh, yeah.
As I said at the top of the show, not only is this movie about a girl boss, this movie was directed by a girl boss. And not just any girl boss. The first girl boss to ever win the Oscar for Best Director, Catherine Bigelow. And I like to think, as Leni Riefenstahl was to the Third Reich, Catherine Bigelow is to whatever you want to call it, the American Empire, America, the Fourth Reich, whatever edgelordy title you want to call it. She is the propagandist of empire. And I recommend to anyone watching the show, the documentary The Amazing and Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl is available for free on YouTube. It is 3 hours long. It mostly consists of interviews and footage of the major Nazi propagandist Leni Riefenstahl, who, it seems fucked to say, but she's pretty apolitical as far as Nazi propagandist goes. There's a scene where she shot several Nazi rallies, most famously with the film Triumph of the Will. And the first one that she did, she was really dissatisfied with the lighting, with the angles, with the product. And you see this old German ex-Nazi get flustered and angry with the interview, saying, I don't want to talk about the first movie. I want to talk about the second movie. That first Nazi propaganda film is not up to snuff. And this woman is narcissistic to the point of being a monster, where she doesn't want to talk about that politics stuff. She wants to talk about her own art that she created and totally divorce it from it. And I feel like Catherine Bigelow is a little bit the same. She wants to talk about the movies. She doesn't want to talk about the politics behind the movies or the substance of the movies. Sorry, I should be more clear. I don't know if she doesn't want to talk about it. I don't know what her personal politics are, but the politics around these films, both The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, was much more around, look at this trailblazing lady director, than it was like, look at this apologia for the fucking empire, right? And that documentary also engages in a little bit of that. Like, the doc is critical of Leni Riefenstahl by letting Leni Riefenstahl speak for herself, is mostly how they criticize her. But there will be weird offhanded lines where, like, the 20s were a trying time in Weimar Germany, but Leni Riefenstahl was really pushing the boundaries of what a woman could do behind the camera
when she was filming Triumph of the Will.
Yeah, that's your Remember Shuffle recommendation. Don't watch Zero Dark Thirty. Watch this different movie. That's even longer. That's all we got from Girl Boss, and we can move it along.
Yeah, I had that small point just about Ghislaine Maxwell, that it's very funny that she's in the news recently being like, of course, pedophile ring about dozens of men, and who's left holding the bag? A woman.
Who's left holding the Prince Andrew doll? You
don't want to. That's what her defense lawyer said. Ever since Eve bit into the apple was the opening line of her opening remarks. The Ghislaine defense was grounded in IDPOL.
I didn't know girl bossing was against the law. So our final theme that we'd like to discuss is the archetype of the bearded operator. This is something that Chapo has talked about a lot, and it is a military figure which has really risen in prominence quite a bit in the last 15 years, to the point where we have a whole plethora of products that are offered to people, not necessarily who are these people who are bearded operators, but people who want to think of themselves as a bearded operator. So if you're a consultant, but you do CrossFit, maybe you buy Black Rifle Coffee or the special beard razors that are meant for tier one operators. Just a quick note, the bearded operator is a figure that they distinguish themselves from regular soldiers because of their beard.
Yes.
Right? The regular army has protocols surrounding mustaches and beards that they ignore because they are a special type of soldier, right? They don't have to follow the uniform code. And this is something you told me, Ben, is that their independence and independent thinking is valued and encouraged because when you're in these situations, there's no one to give you orders. You have to improvise, and your mindset has to be much different than a regular soldier.
I picked up an Audible book years ago called Stealing Fire. And this is, like, I cannot stress enough, a hack business book, right? This is about innovation and disruption. And it's a lot about psychedelics, about how tech bros and the Navy SEALs and all these people, they're thinking outside the box to get into ecstasy, to get into flow
states, to innovate, to steal fire. And this book talks a lot about the Navy SEALs. And so first I want to read you some facts that I lifted from this book before recording. Then I want to read you a couple passages, because I think this is a beautiful example of some facts about the Navy SEALs and then their reception specifically in the context of a dumb business innovation book. So it costs $25,000 to train up a U.S. Marine. The U.S. Marine are no slouches, right? It costs $500,000 to train a Navy SEAL. And that's just the baseline. If you get up into the tippy top, into the dev crew, to get to that peak, you add another $2.5 million of training across all of their rotations. So a 24-man SEAL team costs $85 million. And this is the part of the military, like we talked about just on our Pat Tillman episode. The military is about following fucking orders. We can put the "you can't handle the truth" monologue here if we wanted to. It's about shutting your fucking mouth and manning a post and doing your basic repetitive task. But the SEALs are different because their job description is, are you ready for this, boys? This is kind of fucked up. There is no job description. They are called, and I quote, they are called a multitasking multi-tool. They are VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And they are ambiguous because they ignore international law and they operate in legal gray zones. But those are just the facts about what these guys are in terms of pinnacle peak or what have you and how much they cost. Here's a quote from this book about the concept of group flow and subsuming into the collective. At every step of training, quoting Davis, who was an ex-Navy SEAL, from BUDS is short for Basic Underwater Demolition SEALs, through their last day in dev crew, we are weeding out candidates who cannot shift their consciousness and merge with the team. Jumping down a bit, everything we consider SEAL training is a brutal filtration system, which, beyond the obvious tactical skills and physical perseverance, sorts for exclusively one thing. Does an operator with his back against the wall retreat into himself, or does he merge with his team? It's also how they separate good from great in the fabled Kill House, their specifically designed hostage rescue training facility, where they measure a team's ability to move as one by the millimeter, where success requires an almost superhuman collective awareness. When SEALs sweep a building, says Rich Davis, slow is dangerous. We want to move as fast as possible. To do this, there are only two rules. The first is to do exactly the opposite of what the guy in front of you is doing. So if he looks left, you look right. The second is trickier. The person who knows what to do next is the leader. We are entirely non-hierarchical in that way. But in a combat environment, when split seconds make all the difference, there's no time for second guessing. When someone steps up to become the new leader, everyone automatically moves with him. It's the only way we win. This dynamic subordination, where leadership is fluid and defined by conditions on the ground, is the foundation of flipping the switch.
Do the opposite. Like, if someone canoes a face, you have to uncanoe the face.
You need to reconstruct that face. But yeah, this is the kind of bullshit that's around the Navy SEALs. I don't really believe in any of this, in this like gender fluid, non-hierarchical fucking leadership strategy. They're the guys with the biggest guns and the best night vision goggles.
And this movie doesn't quite put them up on that big of a pedestal. Famously, she goes up to them and she's like, quite frankly, I didn't want to use your guys with your gear and your dip. You know, mm-hmm. These guys are just morons who chew tobacco, but are really athletic. But the fact that we now have to be subjected to these people as business and cultural thought leaders is insane, right? The fact that Jocko Willink is giving out business advice is hilarious.
He has an entire empire of leadership books, leadership seminars, talks, podcasts, because, yeah, he could jump out of a plane good and shoot good.
Yeah, I don't mind these guys individually at all. It's the dupes' fault. I can fault these guys for probably all the murder and larceny they've done, but I can't really fault them. Like, I'm a little gog-pilled, I got to admit. I like Goggins. I even kind of like Jocko a bit, but their existence and popularity is indicative of something very rotten and bad. But I don't know.
I've listened to dozens of hours of Jocko Willink's podcast. Like, he's done the most operations as a SEAL Team 6 leader, I think, of anyone ever. And so he's like an interesting guy. But the idea that he would tell you how to better run your like data science team. I said this on the Halo episode, but I had a boss at an old company in Canada who he had read one of these Jocko Willink books or whatever, someone from the SEAL Team 6, and decided to restructure our organization around the way that the SEALs do it. It's like, dude, what advice do you think? Like,
did you have a non-hierarchical leadership structure with a subsumed collective will, Giordano?
Well, yeah, that's I mean, like, that's the scary part, is that people that wield a lot of power but are built like me see these SEALs and are just, they look up to them so uncritically, mm-hmm. because of that mythos of just how good they are, right? Everything about these tier one operators, the propaganda around them, is that they get the job done because, god damn it, they are just so fucking good at their jobs. Which, by the way, I'm sure they are pretty damn good at their jobs, but at some point, you know, it's also that they have $8 million worth of night vision and like PEC-15s and shit, right? Like,
and they can crash in a $16 million helicopter and just order a new one.
Well, yeah, exactly. Which is something to be feared from the perspective of the person at the receiving end of it. It doesn't matter how they got so deadly, whether it's through their own virtue or through just the equipment behind them. You're dead anyway.
Yeah, no one is arguing that they're not good at their job. The issue, I think, is that they've taken up a place in the culture war. They make these movies with the zombie operator movie where they're like killing the trans zombies and shit like that. Yeah, like they see themselves as cultural critics more than just what they are, which is these elite operators.
Right. They see that because they've hit this, what they see as a peak, right? A peak of martial killing ability, then they are essentially Übermenschen that have peaked in every respect.
The propaganda has been so successful that people look at them as so competent that their max level, their competence ceiling is higher than other industries and professions. People worship tier one operators so much that, again, they think that their competence is so great that it could automatically transfer to like the field of data science or like management, right? That myth making has been successful, obviously, because people in charge of lots and lots of money do actually believe that.
I also will dispute their effectiveness or competency. I'm going to be an obtuse Donald Trump style take here. How good could they be? America lost all those wars. You had the best special forces in the world who completed all their missions and you still lost the war. Congrats. Enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I think the conclusion that you can draw from that is more that having the most competent soldiers, even if you literally do, it still won't stop you from getting blown up by an anti-tank mine.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Bin Laden was something of a bearded operator himself.
True. True. And he fell for Robin Williams doing an impression of his son.
Not his son, his wife.
You know, out there, there's a Robin Williams impression of a terrorist that's racist as fuck.
Oh, yes.
Well, one day we get Osama bin Laden, he goes to the gates of heaven. There's George Washington waiting, going, how dare you defile that which we created, and starts wailing on his ass. 70 other members of the Continental Congress come down and start kicking the shit out of him. And then he's going, what is this? Where are the virgins? 71 Virginians, you asshole. And St. Peter goes, hey, Jesus, did you call a cab? Come here.
We have a guy that is a millionaire doing that still.
Oh, yeah. We have to do a Jeff Dunham episode at some point.
Oh, God. Thank you.
And so I think, and this is something we talked about on Halo, that when you're in a 20-year occupation, you need some kind of soldier to celebrate. And it's really hard to celebrate the occupation soldier because there's just not that much exciting stuff going on. And 40% of the casualties are from fratricide. So what do you do?
40% of friendly fire. I wonder what other percent is like booby trapped IEDs. I'd guess as high as like another 30 or 40.
So yeah. Like, and so what can you do? Who do you have to celebrate? Well, you have the special forces, guys who are kidnapping people in the middle of the night based on information that one of their neighbors gave you that was feuding with them. Mm-hmm. You know, famously.
We weren't able to cut off the head of the snake, but we did trim the tail of the snake using our special forces. So think about that.
Yeah, I love that Chris Pratt does mention the Tony Robbins thing, just alluding to like how self-serving these guys are, mm-hmm. to be like, this is a great business opportunity for all of us.
Yes, they are interesting as an organization. I think that they're bad for the world, but they're the opposite of what you think a soldier should be. And yeah, they've built this entire apparatus, an entire business apparatus around themselves. How many books are there out there by guys who were on the Bin Laden mission who claim to have killed Bin Laden? And some of them get their jump start into politics. Like, okay, yeah, we got all the people who write their lying books. We got Jocko Willink with his absolute cultural empire. And then, of course, we got motherfucking Dan Crenshaw used as a springboard to go into politics.
I don't mind the politicians as much as I do the cultural pacemakers. Mm. That kind of makes sense to me that someone who did service would then go on to politics. But yeah, just the idea that you're going to make art, especially if it's reactionary art, like, mm-hmm. we're going to shoot all the blue-haired liberals, you know, or whatever, like...
Yeah, the this is just a great early example of it on film.
All of them have beards. I watched today and I was like, yeah, beard, mm-hmm. or at least scruff.
As JD pointed out, that scene is so good because it's, I guess, like demystifying, you could say is the word. It's not sensationalist. So yeah, they're bearded operators. They're tacked up as fuck. They're kind of dicks. They're dicks to Jessica Torturer. And as you said, they listen to Tony Robbins. They're glory hogs. It is kind of a warts and all portrayal of the bearded operator.
I just wanted to mention that the studio that made this movie is called Annapurna Pictures, and it was founded by Megan Ellison, who's the daughter of billionaire tech mutant Larry Ellison. This is a guy who's like 80 years old, but he looks 40, likely due to blood transfusions. And what's that other thing that rich people are always accused of doing?
Adrenochrome.
Yes. And everything I say about Larry Ellison, by the way, is alleged, but I used to live in San Francisco and I did meet several women who claimed that he was paying their rent in exchange for meeting up with him at least once a month or once every 2 months to have sex with him. He famously is supporting just an army of sugar babies in San Francisco and one of the biggest billionaire tech mutants in the world. We are planning a potential billionaire tech mutant episode in the future, so maybe we'll cover Larry Ellison more in full at a later date. But his daughter has this fortune, right? And she wanted to do something good with the money because she knows it's from this evil source. And so she founded a movie studio that was aimed at making movies that would be too risky for a traditional business to try, right? Because by the late 2000s, early 2010s, we've talked about this before in our video games episode, movie making has become a business primarily. And so something like this might be considered too risky. Although it's interesting to note that I guess 2012 had two other operator movies comes out. So how are you really risking? She wanted to follow Silicon Valley principles with her movie making, which was trying to get out something with a message, something risky, because she doesn't really care if she loses money, given that she's going to inherit billions of dollars anyway. And so she has actually made some really good movies, Annapurna Pictures. Her, I'm a big fan of. You like The Hurt Locker, right, Ben?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, as I'll talk about shortly. Oh, she did American Hustle. That's not bad.
I like that one, but it really is just too bad that the path for us to get a good movie now has to just be like, oh, well, one of the children of one of our oligarchs happens to have a sensitivity to making these movies. There's no other way to get inspired work. I liked Vice. I'm a little biased in that I have a 2000s podcast.
Sure.
And I love Adam McKay. But so yeah, she's actually made some good movies. And it's just kind of a shame that, okay, you want a movie outside the studio system? You can have the tech oligarch child movie.
The tech oligarch troop worshiping pro torture movie. Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I want to, in this miscellaneous section, I want to say I had the time to watch The Hurt Locker, Catherine Bigelow's first Global War on Terror movie. And maybe it's because I was watching it on 2x speed like a zoomer, but it rocked. I liked it a lot. It's way more based. It's a lot better than Zero Dark Thirty. There's a great scene where Jeremy Renner, wild ass white boy who doesn't play by any of the rules, it's very much like an 80s or 90s action movie where he is hyper competent, but he's just fucking crazy, dude. He's a bomb diffuser for the rush of it, just for the thrill of it. And he puts everyone else in danger to go bomb diffusing. But there's a scene where he's walking up to this octuple IED that's done together, and all the other soldiers are terrified. They're looking around this fucking bazaar, looking for who might have the cell phone to set off the IED. And this car pulls up to Jeremy Renner as he's undoing it. Jeremy Renner, like a fucking sheriff in the old west, whips out his Glock and he's pointing his gun at the driver of the car. And there's this standoff. He shoots at the ground. He breaks the windshield. Eventually, the guy gets the message and he starts reversing in his car. And the other fucking Marines or Army guys or whatever rip him out of his car and they arrest him and they take him off to go be tortured by Jessica Chastain's character in the next movie. And Jeremy Renner has this incredibly base line where he just says, well, if he wasn't an insurgent before, he sure as hell is now. And I'm like, damn. Yeah, there we
go. Read your book.
Yeah. And in every single way, it's way more based because this guy, he's not in it for patriotism or glory or avenging 9/11. He's just a guy who he has shot his adrenal glands by being a bomb diffuser for so long. So the only time he derives any joy in life at all is by bomb diffusing. Kind of like a Michael Mann movie about a guy who's just like insanely good at his job. He keeps every detonator in a box under his bed as trophies of all of the bombs he's diffused. Because it came out in like 08 or 09, you do have that big late 2000s, early 10s pivot to mental health. A lot of mental health discussion. The movie ends with him going back to the home front and he's married to fucking Evangeline Lilly from Lost and he has a kid and he still can't feel anything. And so he goes back to Iraq. And it's like, dang. It's not worshipy in that sniveling, look at the sacrifices this guy is making for his country. Because he fucking hates his family. He doesn't want to be with them. He's not sacrificing anything. Zero Dark Thirty was allegedly half inspired by the Looming Tower. But I mean, Giordano, you've read it and you didn't recognize much Looming Tower in Zero Dark Thirty.
It's really hard to say that this was inspired by the Looming Tower, because the Looming Tower is, it's a portrait of the people responsible for 9/11. And there's just none of that in Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah,
they're just names and pictures and a nose that you see. Like,
yeah. The Hurt Locker was inspired by a series of articles in none other than Playboy. Read it from the articles about these guys who went and defused bombs in Iraq. And yeah, it's like a portrayal of this type of guy. And yeah, I found it way more entertaining than Zero Dark Thirty.
All right, then I guess we can move on to the conclusion. Mm-hmm. Then I have a couple concluding points. I got to put this somewhere. The historical context, everybody knows the Bin Laden raid took place right after the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where Barack Obama was ripping on Trump about, the decisions you have to make on The Apprentice, like who to fire, you know, those would keep me up at night.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God you're handling that stuff. People say that he had that swag because he knew that the raid was happening while he was giving the speech, and it sort of gave him some extra swagger. And then the next night, the Apprentice finale was on, which was bumped by the president's announcement that he had killed Obama. Or, sorry, fucking Christ. That he had killed Bin Laden.
Oh my God.
And so one more thing that maybe Donald Trump was itching about when he ran for president.
A real, they called me Mr. Glass moment for Donald Trump when they bumped The Apprentice. And, you know, luckily Obama, you know, slighted Donald Trump and he won in the end.
In conclusion, we talk a lot on this pod about the end of history because it is one of the defining ideals of the late 90s and early 2000s, because September 11th was said to sort of put an end to the end of history. It was an attempt for someone with different ideas than our own saying, hey, this discussion is not finished. There are people out there that have different ideas about how society should be run, and not everybody has folded into this rational, classical thought. And this movie is concerned with this idea of the neoliberal order being upended by Al-Qaeda and us being forced to essentially give up our esteemed ideals, not being forced, but us indulging in giving up our professed ideals to fight them by resorting to this barbaric torture.
Yeah, don't watch it. It's not good.
I would disagree.
Yeah?
I would say you like watch the torture scenes and then watch the raid, but just watch those scenes on YouTube. You don't have to watch the whole movie.
Yeah.
I disagree. At least for anyone in your audience that's actually interested in propaganda, tell you what, anyone that saw the woke CIA ad and that made them feel something like just gaslit. This movie, I think we have not managed to get across, despite our best efforts, how insulting to your intelligence, how crazy making, how gaslighting this movie actually is. Because recall that this was made, 8, 9 years, 10 years before the woke CIA ad. It's the same thing. Like, it is the beginnings of them realizing, like, okay, we can launder our sick imperialism through this language that the people we're trying to get to just get absolutely,
it's like
just fall for so easily.
Yeah, it's like catnip to them.
When we watched this movie, I told two people close to me, the next two people I talked to on the damn phone, I started talking about this movie and I just would go on for so long, was like, I'm sorry, I don't want you to go through seeing this movie, but I need someone to feel the way I felt watching this movie, because it does feel like a person standing there gaslighting you to your face. It's
you're absolutely really right. That is such a better conclusion, which is that this movie is an attempt to launder our barbarity through these liberal ideas, right? Like girl bossing, like the woke CIA, right? Exactly. This idea that, hey, we might be sexually humiliating people and freezing them to death, but we're neurodivergent and
we got problems too.
Yeah, we have imposter syndrome. And that's exactly what a certain other country is trying to do right now, right? Saying, hey, 50% of our bombers are women and queer women.
Yeah, I found this movie, like JD, just very discouraging to watch.
Yeah.
Especially as someone who lived through the brief window of hope of 2008-09 and was aware of it. I'm sorry, y'all, the empire is perpetual. Until it really fucking loses, the empire is with us to stay, because it's going to morph. The national security state is going to morph. Think about the seamlessness with which we went from the right-wing torture hero protagonist in Jack Bauer on network TV, the fictional character who's cited by Scalia in decisions around torture. We go from the red-blooded Jack Bauer, played by a Canadian, to the cerebral lady torturer in the lady-directed Catherine Bigelow Thinking Man's torture movie. What is the constant? The constant is empire. That's not changing. How we talk about it is going to morph along with the times and along with customs and along with culture, and it's going to end up with the woke CIA ad. But the empire, the 800 bases, the CIA, all the three-letter acronym agencies, those are all with us. I hate to use this metaphor again, but they're only going down with the thousand-year Reich. Okay? That's the only way they're going.
Yeah, it's hard when you watch this movie. It does. Like, I want other people to be subjected to the ineffable feeling I had watching this movie that, well, it's ineffable, so I can't describe it. But it's just like, you watch this movie and remember that this is one of the most critically acclaimed movies of the decade. People still love this movie.
It won Oscars.
Yeah, and it's hard not to watch this and be like, even though it's, you know, it's from that long ago, like, be like, oh, they're winning. They won. They're winning. The rage is sick, though.
Sorry, it was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, but luckily it only won 1 for Best Sound Editing. Oh, sorry, it tied. It tied Skyfall, so.
I didn't know you could tie. Wow.
Yeah, apparently.
It does make me think a little bit about one of the closing lines of Osama bin Laden's letter to America.
Osama Hussein bin Laden.
Who said every day 3 American soldiers kill themselves. How many Talibani soldiers do you think kill themselves every day? This idea that even if you win on the battlefield, you're forced to live with what you've become through your conquest.
Damn.
And fire. You can try to launder it all you want with the
movies.
What?
With movies.
Yeah, with movies or these like ideals that you think are somehow putting you in the moral authority. But at the end of the day, like, we all feel bad about the fact that our country had to do torture.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's been your Remember Shuffle, following up our Pat Tillman episode with another happy one on Zero Dark Thirty and torture in the decade. As always, thank you so much for listening. Huge shout out to our guest, JD. Always a pleasure, bud. You are now in the lead. I think you've overtaken Kyle for the most appearances.
I think you're at 7 now.
I feel like I'm winning.
Yeah. So as always, please like, please subscribe. If you comment, we respond. If you share something on Instagram, we put it on our story.
But yeah, you know, Ben and I, we don't have a Patreon or anything. We figured for now our like natural enthusiasm is enough to keep us doing the show. But it's always a huge boost to our enthusiasm when we see someone either leave a comment saying they like the show, or better yet, tweets that they like the show, or post an Instagram story about it. So yeah. we truly like, it does make us profoundly happy to see those. So thank you.
And if you are a torturer who wants to use our voice, please reach out. Reach out for a collab.
We will subject them to Kyle's 20-minute monologue about the Da Vinci Code sequels.
Yes.
From the Da Vinci Code episode that you can play for them.
All right, that's all we got for you today. Ciao, ciao.
Peace.
All right.
Finest girl I ever met in my whole life. Wanted to take her home, make her my wife. Knew she was a freak when she started talking. She said, fuck me like we fucked Bin Laden. Ooh, that girl was a freak. She said she wanted me to fuck her.
Your request is so irregular. She put on a beard, I started looking at the exit door. Then a turban, then a tunic. She said, invade my cave with your special unit. I said he wasn't in a cave, but there was no stopping. She demanded that I fuck her like we fuck Bin Laden.